You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and I'm speaking with Patty Gerace, Marketing Director for Walker Furniture. The Vegas-born company is seeking nomination letters for its 9th annual Help for Heroes program to help wounded, active military, or veterans with specialized furniture. Patty, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So how long has Walker Furniture been a mainstay in the Las Vegas Valley?
We have been here for 68 years.
That's amazing. How many locations are there now?
We have two stores, one on MLK and one in Green Valley. And we also have a warehouse outlet and also an outlet on our MLK that services all of our locations.
Nice. Okay. So tell us more about the Help for Heroes program. What is it all about?
It's really a great program. This is our 9th year, as you said, and we get letters from the community, and that's what we need help with. We need your listeners, people in the community, to send in letters if they know of a military, either veteran or active military person that has special needs and needs some specialized furniture. We do things like lift chairs, adjustable beds, furniture that has motion in it so that they can get up and down easily. It really is a great program. This is something that Walker has been doing for like 9 years for this program, plus all the other community programs that we have. But it's really important that the community helps support the veterans and active military people in our community. And if they know of somebody, if they could write a letter, send it in to Walker Furniture. Go online to our walkerfurniture.com and click on the link, which gives you the submission page. It would be really helpful.
So where does this specialized furniture come from when, let's say, you choose, okay, Bob, he needs this special bed configured for him. Yes. Where does that come from then?
We order all this special furniture for the veterans program through our vendors and comes from our inventory if we have what they need, like a lift chair or an adjustable bed. But we have great vendors that love to support our mission also, and they give us great prices. We pay for everything. We deliver it to the families. We have people that have just loved the program and love to go out on these deliveries and help these veterans because, you know, lots of times the VA doesn't give them other than medical assistance. And if they need specialized furniture, it's hard for them to get that.
So how many people will you be supplying furniture for this year?
12 active or veteran in the community. It's not like our Home for the Holidays where we do 35 families. But because this is a specialized furniture, the cost is a little higher. So we can only do that so many in the veterans program.
So what are the criteria for being chosen to be one of those 12 people to receive the specialized furniture?
Well, the letters go through a process. We have help from our American lead post 149, and they go out and they actually visit the possible recipients. And they evaluate their needs, they check their military background, and they put in recommendations of what the military person needs to make their life a little easier every single day.
That's awesome. Okay, so you mentioned writing letters and submitting them online, or how else can listeners nominate someone for this program?
They can write a letter, they can mail it, or they can drop it off at Green Valley or our MLK location, and we will get them to the post 149 people who are the ones that go out and do the home visits.
Okay, perfect. And what's the deadline to submit a letter?
The deadline is July 8th. We usually do it right at Memorial Day, and it runs all the way through June for the submission process. And then on July 8th, we have the final recipient selected and we notify them and we have a luncheon for them and their families. And the Las Vegas Rescue Mission helps them with food and any other services that might be needed. And we also have Roadkill Grill is a partner of ours and they supply the luncheon for the veterans and their families. it's a nice way to honor them for what they've given to our country. And it's a great way to have them know that there are people in the community that care about them.
Yeah, absolutely. So what should be in the letter? What kind of information do you need to make the decision?
Just their situation and what type of furniture they might need, what kind of help they're looking for. Mostly just describing what their day-to-day life is like and how we can help make it better.
Okay. So is it normally family members who are submitting these letters, or do the veterans and military people submit the letters themselves?
It can be anyone. It can be any person. They can write it themselves, family members, other people that may know of someone in the community that needs some help. We've had letters come in from doctors and other people that know of their situation. But if someone did write a letter for themselves, we definitely look into all of those. And the post 149 people go out and assess all the needs of these veterans.
Nice. Okay. So the deadline is July 8th to submit the letter, and then you'll be having luncheon for the recipients within the next few weeks after that?
Right. Yeah. About a week later, after we've notified everybody, then we invite them to this luncheon. And it's just a really neat time and be able to have their little family time and really thank them for their service.
Yeah, that's a really fast turnaround. Wow, you guys are fast.
We've been doing it for a while. And because of our Home for the Holidays program, which is 35 families, which is huge. It's a big endeavor to put that together every year. But we do our best to get all the furniture out to the families at Christmas time. And with the veterans, we try to turn that around in like a week to 10 days.
Awesome. Okay. So you mentioned the website walkerfurniture.com, and they can submit a nomination letter there for the Help for Heroes program. And that needs to be done by July 8th, right? So they just go to walkerfurniture.com and submit the letter, or drop it off to one of the stores. You've got one in Green Valley and one on MLK.
Correct. Yeah. And it's a really simple link. You just go to the website and there's a link that'll take you right to the page, tells you about the program. And then there's a nominate page and you fill in that information. It goes directly to the post 149 people. And they go out again, like I said, and interview all the possible recipients. Yes.
Perfect. Okay. So walkerfurniture.com is the easiest place to go to. You can get more information there about the Help for Heroes program, walkerfurniture.com. If you want to nominate someone or yourself, veteran or active military, who's in need of specialized furniture, just write the letter describing the need, why that person would be a good recipient, and that letter needs to be submitted by July 8th. You can either do it right there at walkerfurniture.com, or you can drop it off to either of their stores, the Green Valley location or the MLK location, and just take it right in and drop it there. So again, your deadline is July 8th and the website walkerfurniture.com. And Patty, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about this program. It's fantastic that you're doing this for the veterans and the active military who need specialized furniture, because I know specialized furniture can be extremely expensive. So the fact that this program exists and they can just make an easy nomination and get that specialized furniture that they need, that's incredible. So amazing what you guys are doing. And thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about it.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate your support and we appreciate the help in getting the word out to the community so we can get those letters and we can help those families in need.
Hi, I'm Bob Maxwell, CEO of Voice of the Veteran. In the last year, we have helped secure nearly $4 million in aid and lifetime benefits for veterans. If you're a veteran, call us today at 702-381-2566.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm speaking with Jeff Breaux, Executive Vice President of Cox Business. Jeff has 35 years of experience in the telecom and IT industry, and he's responsible for the strategic direction of one of Cox's largest growth divisions. Smart technology is booming, and living in a smart city improves quality of life by 30%. Jeff, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure, Heather. Thank you for having me.
So what exactly is a smart city?
Well, Heather, I'm calling today from Mesa, Arizona, and where we're hosting an event called Smarter Arizona. And just at a very high level, Smarter Arizona is an interactive event designed to highlight the full power of both broadband as well as managed services that create and support smart cities, smart homes, smarter work environments. So a smart city is really a community that's in touch with their community members, their local businesses, and their infrastructure needs. And putting all that together, leveraging the most powerful and up-to-date technology with the goals of improving quality of life, making the city safer, making cities greener, solving key community challenges, creating new business opportunities, and making them more efficient to navigate.
Nice. Okay. Now, Mesa, Arizona is not that far from us here in Las Vegas. Do you know how Las Vegas is planning on using smart technology?
Well, Heather, I'm glad you mentioned it because Las Vegas is, in my opinion, a leader in smart technologies. I would give you a couple of advanced examples, primarily around safety. So if you think about how, you know, technology can help us make our cities and our environments more safe, you rely on things like, you know, I refer to the Internet of Things or IoT. So think of IoT as connected endpoints or assets that might not normally be connectivity enabled. But by doing so, there's a number of ways that you can leverage the technology to improve and enforce safety procedures and things within communities. So the one great example I would give you is where we've used computer vision-based solutions. So think cameras and analytics that surround the cameras at Baker Park there in Las Vegas. And so we process about 30 plus million images per day from Baker Park. And it was primarily to help the community officials make sure that they were managing that the start and end times for the day. They were getting a lot of after hours violations. There were some safety reports at the park. And I'm happy to report that since we've implemented the solution at Baker Park, they have been zero after hours violations. So the community officials are just really, really pleased with it. And again, we've been just super excited about the partnership with Baker Park. And then I'll just quickly mention another one, and it's related to curbside management solutions. So if you think about the tourism and the traffic in Las Vegas, there's a collection of folks that are in the downtown area that have implemented a curbside management solution, similar kind of capabilities with computer vision, where you have limited time to do pickups and drop-offs at high traffic areas in the downtown area. So just a couple of examples where it's lending to safety. And again, Las Vegas tends to be a leader in adoption of new technology.
Nice. Okay. So obviously safety is a great use of smart technology, but how can it help cities reduce their carbon footprint?
Yeah, so it's a really, really good question on the carbon footprint. I got a couple of really good examples I would share with you. The first is around, I mentioned before, Internet of Things or enabling things that would not normally have connectivity. You can't have a water meter, just shout out or post something on an app. A water meter just left to itself is just going to kind of do its thing. So one of the areas that we've focused is enabling smart water meters so that the water meter can report on, hey, if it's developing an early leak, maybe there's early freeze detection. There's some things we can do around making sure that we can appropriately send out a maintenance crew so that you can avoid a failure or other things to make sure we're saving on water. So you're saving on truck rolls for maintenance, you're saving on water. And the other one is we've done some great work with respect to smart street lighting. So think of street lights that are also connectivity enabled that can communicate if they're having, maybe again, a maintenance issue. Maybe we can use less energy at certain times of the day when there's no traffic passing by. And again, try to reduce truck rolls and make that energy use on the light poles and the smart street lighting more efficient and more effective. Just a couple of examples on the carpet.
Yeah, awesome. So the big buzz lately seems to be artificial intelligence or AI. In what ways does smart technology make use of AI?
Yeah, so it's a really, really great question. And I would give you the landscape of smart cities and smart technologies, connected environments. They're all enabled by about four things. First is that connectivity, just thinking of, fiber and, 5G or other types of connectivity. Then it's the infrastructure, mostly from a compute standpoint. So think, where do you put the computing capability, in the cloud and things like that? And then one of the most important things is making sure that you have data and decisioning. So that's where the analytics and the AI comes in. And again, today it's more about analyzing data. And as I mentioned before, the computer-enabled vision, things with video that we can do that are just very capable today. But using AI and machine learning, it will only get better. And then the fourth pillar is really the interaction and the experience of community members, or maybe the experience of someone going to the convention center in Las Vegas or Allegiant Stadium. So it's, again, those four pillars of connectivity, compute infrastructure, data and decisioning, which is where analytics comes in and AI comes in. And again, the interactions with the humans and the experience they may have as they interact with the park or with a convention center or stadium.
Awesome. So you've mentioned a lot of instances where smart technology is already being used to improve the lives of residents, but what are we looking forward to in the future? What do you expect us to see 5 years, 10 years from now?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to predict the future, but I think we're really on the front end of the growth curve around all things connected in smart city, even though it's a very, very large business today around the country. And I think, you know, the creative things, and you saw some of the technology companies even announce some things around AR and VR and some newer technology this week. I don't know that we could predict where we're going to be in 5 or 10 years, but I will tell you that things that are more in the physical world will be enabled through connectivity, and they'll be able to have a voice so that we can use those assets and those endpoints in our physical world much more effectively, more efficiently, with a better quality of life and a safer environment, and just leaning on all the dimensions of how and why cities are looking at that, at smart communities and smart environments.
Awesome. Okay. So where can listeners go if they want to learn more about smart technology, how the smart cities are developing, and basically how technology is making their lives better?
They can certainly go to cox.com/business if they want to learn more about Cox Business.
All right. Awesome. So once again, cox.com/business is the website to go to. cox.com/business. You can find out more about smart technology and how it's being used in smart cities. cox.com/business. And Jeff, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about smart technology, smart cities, and how Las Vegas is leading the charge. So a lot of great news there and things to look forward to. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Really appreciate it.
Our committee's work towards creating a lasting 1 October memorial is almost complete. 5 design concepts for a memorial are on display at the Clark County Government Center. To meet the design teams and learn more about the concepts, visit our website. You can also take part in a short online survey through June 29th. The survey results will be part of the criteria used by the committee to make its recommendations to the County Commission for a memorial project.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and I'm Heather Vail. Joining me is Lisa Hamilton, President and CEO of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. The foundation just released the 2023 Kids Count data book, which shows that many parents are struggling to find childcare that's compatible with their work schedules and commutes. Lisa, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the Annie E. Casey Foundation?
The Annie E. Casey Foundation is a national foundation based in Baltimore, and we're devoted to making sure all children and youth in the United States have a bright future. So our work focuses on strengthening families, building stronger communities, and ensuring access to opportunity, because we know that kids and families need all three to succeed.
Okay, and what's the Kids Count data book?
The annual Kids Count data book tracks how children are faring nationally and in every state using 16 indicators related to economic well-being, education, health, and family and community factors. And then the data book ranks the states for each indicator as well as overall child well-being. So we publish the data book every year to provide decision makers and the public with reliable data on child well-being in order to inform better policy decisions.
Okay, now what are some of the insights on child well-being that you discovered from this year's report?
Well, this year we are highlighting the most recent data, which is from 2021, which means we now have a partial picture of how the pandemic affected kids and families. Half of the 16 indicators, 8 indicators, worsened compared to last year's data book. 4 stayed the same and 4 improved. So the challenging news, if you reflect back on the height of the pandemic, so many parents lost their jobs and our children were oftentimes learning virtually. So the data reflects that fewer parents were financially stable or had jobs, and educational achievement was hit hard. Even so, child poverty remained unchanged and more children were insured, which shows that good policy decisions can help kids and families get through tough times.
Yeah, okay. So you said that you ranked the different states. How does Nevada rank among the other states?
Well, Nevada is ranked 47th this year because of data challenges. At the beginning of the pandemic, we aren't really comparing prior years to this year, but that means Nevada still has room for improvement in making smart policy decisions on behalf of kids and families. The domain where Nevada ranked the best was in the health domain. I wish I could say that the numbers were going in the right direction, but it does suggest that some of Nevada's choices around healthcare are helping it rank higher. But there's certainly room for improvement around economic well-being and education and family and community indicators.
Okay. What sorts of policies need to be put in place to put this all in a positive direction?
Well, we know that when policymakers invest in children and families, that can address the challenges that are facing communities. Investments in education, investments in children's health care and their parents' health care, investments that help more parents access good quality jobs, all help to improve the trends in states we've seen over time. It's also important to pay attention to the challenges that certain demographics might be facing. And so when states invest in working to reduce racial or ethnic disparities, that can also help them improve their rankings.
Okay. What can we do about the situation?
Well, we provide information in the data book every year to help particularly policymakers make better decisions. So we hope that listeners and the public and policymakers will look at this information, assess where their state is, and then put in place good policies like child tax credits or earned income tax credits that really help provide economic stability for families or investments in education that can help improve outcomes for children. That's why we provide this data, so that it can inform any policy decision that's being considered related to kids and families.
Okay, so where can we go to learn more about the situation or to access the data that you put out this year in the Kids Count Data Book?
The Kids Count Data Book is available at www.aecf.org, and you can find the data book itself, a profile of your state, and millions of data points about kids, families, and communities.
Okay, awesome. So once again, the website to go to is aecf.org. It stands for the Annie E. Casey Foundation, aecf.org. And you can find out more data in the Kids Count Data Book about what is going on with childcare and child well-being in the country across all the states. So once again, aecf.org. And Lisa, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about what's going on and how we can make a difference. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Every child deserves a safe, loving, and permanent home. Help the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption find families for children who've lingered in foster care the longest. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Amy Wimpy Knight, president of the Children's Hospital Association. The association is hosting its 18th annual Family Advocacy Day in Washington, D.C., the first in-person event since the COVID-19 pandemic. Amy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Heather, and thank you for bringing this important topic to your viewers.
Yeah, so before we get into it, for people that aren't familiar, what exactly is the Children's Hospital Association?
Children's Hospital Association is a national organization of more than 200 children's hospitals nationwide, working together in a variety of ways to better the healthcare of children in our nation and in our community.
Okay, and what is Family Advocacy Day?
So Family Advocacy Day is an annual opportunity. I think, as you noted earlier, it's the 18th year, but it's an exciting time when we bring children and families from states across the country to Washington, D.C. to tell their own personal healthcare stories to the members of Congress and to advocate for issues important and unique to children's health in many ways. So we have an opportunity this year to have nearly 50 children and families joining us, and they will be all over Capitol Hill meeting with congressional leaders over the next couple of days to talk about the issues important to children's health.
What are some of the important issues that you're highlighting to Congress at this year's event?
Yeah, you know, there's ongoing issues, and then there's issues specific to the families. So a couple of things just at the broad level that we're focusing on this year. Obviously, health insurance is incredibly important to all of us and to children. Medicaid and CHIP, which are two federally sponsored health insurance programs that cover kids. More than 50% of the children in our country rely on Medicaid or CHIP for their healthcare coverage. And so ensuring that that program is strong for kids is a topic that we will be spending time on. About half of the kids that are here in DC this week rely on Medicaid or CHIP for their own insurance, so they can speak firsthand as to how we can make improvements in the reimbursement levels and the programs that they offer. Also important, we'll be talking a little bit about workforce and specifically training programs to grow the number of pediatric doctors, nurses, therapists, any kind of specially trained caregiver to ensure that we have timely access for kids. And then finally, we'll be talking about an issue that has been of high importance over the last number of years, which is really children's mental health and our continuing need to grow our programs and our services to be able to meet children and families where they are in a timely manner, whether it be in their community, their schools, or in a more acute program to address children's mental health.
Why is it so important to focus on children's mental health issues?
You know, children's mental health is something we've been talking about for a couple of years. In 2021, we declared a national emergency, CHA did, in conjunction with the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatrists, because we had seen really over the prior decade a huge increase in the number of children accessing and needing mental health services. When we look at the pandemic, it exacerbated that need, and we saw really unmanageable numbers of children experiencing mental health crises with the system unprepared to meet those needs. So that is the issue we're focusing on with Congress this year, is making sure that we have the programs and the providers to meet kids at the right place at the right time for mental health services. Just like many physical ailments like asthma or something like that, if caught early, we can impact children lifelong and their ability to address mental health and manage their mental health issues in a very manageable way. So we're focusing on the timeliness and access to care for mental health and making sure that we are standing up on reimbursing programs and services in the right way for children.
Perfect. Okay. Now, you're focusing on Congress to make changes at the legislative level, but what can we as individuals do to help?
Absolutely. And I think advocacy is really, and advocacy sounds like a big word, but it is really all of our responsibility. So it's fantastic. And I can tell you, just having been in some of these meetings, it's really impactful for children to tell their own stories to congressional leaders. But as citizens and everyday, we can do a lot in that regard. So one, we can elevate the needs of children within our own communities, our own schools, our own cities and states, and we can help them tell their stories. So many of us are also parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, friends, and just continuing, probably the simplest way to be an advocate is to pay attention to the needs of the children in your life and make sure that they have timely access to care by identifying resources available to them. And then, of course, advocating for resources for children overall.
Okay, awesome. So where can we go to learn more about this issue or about the Children's Hospital Association?
Yes, so Children's Hospital Association, we have a website, which is childrenshospitals.org. So many of the issues that we've talked about today are captured there. Would also encourage you just locally in Las Vegas and throughout the state to tap into your local pediatric resources, the American Academy of Pediatrics, your local children's hospitals, serving kids, and just identifying where their priorities are and what they're working on as well. So all of those resources are available to you. And Speak Our Minds is a great new campaign focused on driving real solutions in pediatric mental health. So it's a campaign you'll begin to learn more about as well.
Okay, awesome. So Speak Our Minds campaign is focusing on children's mental health. You can also look into the American Academy of Pediatrics and see what resources they have. And if you want to find out more about the Children's Hospital Association and what they're undertaking on Family Advocacy Day and throughout the year, check out their website, childrenshospitals.org. Children's with an S, hospitals with an S.org, childrenshospitals.org. And Amy, I want to thank you so much for being here and shedding some light on these issues, letting us know what you're working on, what's important, and how we can all make a difference. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Thanks for having me.
When I was younger, I may have did some stupid things, even committed some crimes, but I am not a criminal.
Youth Advocate Programs is a community-based alternative to youth incarceration, congregate placement, and neighborhood violence. Learn how at yapinc.org.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Caroline Yost, breast cancer survivor and global marketing lead of the oncology portfolio at Invitae. June is National Cancer Survivor Month, so it's time to celebrate and acknowledge that life after a cancer diagnosis is a reality for more than 18 million Americans. Caroline, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Heather.
So could you share with us, what has your journey as a breast cancer survivor been like?
Yeah, absolutely. So my mom had breast cancer in 2006, and we have quite a bit of cancer in our family. And so I was really diligent about preventative cancer screenings, really since my mom was diagnosed. And so in 2018, I went in for my annual breast exam with my breast specialist, thinking it was just going to be an in and out thing like usual, but they discovered a mass. And the doctor actually said, you know what, we're going to do a biopsy while you're here. And so we did that. But she also recommended that I do a genetic test with Invitae so that I could gain insights into my inherited risks. And it honestly ended up informing my entire cancer journey. And so as a survivor, I've kind of turned my patient story into a passion by joining the company that makes the genetic test that I took.
Okay, so you knew that your mom had breast cancer, so therefore you might have some genetic predisposition towards getting cancer. But how did that genetic testing impact or change your cancer journey?
Well, pretty dramatically. So what my doctor recommended is that I do the STAT, which just means a fast test, to find out if I had any of what she called the big scary gene variants, like BRCA1 or 2, you know, the ones that we hear a lot about in the news. But she said I could expand the test to cover dozens of different variants. And I really wasn't so sure that I wanted to know all that at first. So while I was waiting for the STAT test to come back, which took about 2 weeks, my husband and I talked about it a lot. And I just kind of landed in a place that I decided this information can empower me to make decisions about my care moving forward if I know that I have gene variants. So fortunately, the STAT test came back negative. But the larger panel did reveal a variant in the gene that's called PMS2, and it increases the risks of other cancers, but one of them is endometrial cancers. And so I decided to have a double mastectomy as well as a prophylactic or preventative total hysterectomy due to my risks.
Now, you mentioned that it is kind of scary to find out that information. So, you know, when we're weighing the pros and cons, is the scary information better or worse than not knowing at all?
You know, people have different opinions about that. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to know it. But to me, having information, it empowered me to make decisions about my health journey. And, you know, I hope that my sharing my story encourages people to consider doing it, because it is scary, but at the same time, scary is okay if you're talking about being able to prevent or catch cancer early.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would you say to someone who is in the same position that you were in and deciding they might know that there's some genetic disposition based on what they've seen in their own family, but they really want to get those answers and they're just not sure if this is the right approach? What would you say to them?
I would just encourage them to do it. You know, if I didn't do this, I would worry more about what I don't know than what I do know at this point. So I actually, before I even started working at Invitae, once I had my diagnosis and my genetic variant was discovered, I was telling everybody, listen, please consider getting genetic testing. Talk to your doctor about it. I personally think that everybody should have genetic testing done as part of their medical record. And I hope that one day that's a reality, because to me, especially with cancer, it again, it's just prevention and catching it early is such an important part of the journey.
So what exactly is involved in the genetic testing process? Is it a blood test? Is it a spit test?
Yeah, it can. It actually can be either one. I spit in a tube and it was super easy. I mean, you wouldn't want to be on video doing it, right? fill a little line. It's, you just spit in a tube and that's it. Super easy.
Okay. And how does this type of genetic testing compare to what's available through, you know, those family tree type of tests?
Yeah, so Invitae is considered a medical grade genetic test. And so I think that's the main thing.
Okay, so we're going to get more information and more actionable information from doing a medical genetic test.
Right.
Okay, so where can people go for more information about getting genetic testing if they're considering it, or if they just want to find out more information before talking with their primary care physician?
Yeah, they can just go to our website. It's Invitae.com, Invitae.com.
Okay.
And yeah, talk to your doctor about it.
Nice. Okay. So Invitae.com is the website to go to, Invitae.com, Invitae.com. And you can find out more information there about genetic testing that can help you know whether you're predisposed to cancers or other diseases, presumably, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So if you want to find out, instead of just waiting and seeing what happens when it comes up, you can find out in advance by doing medical genetic testing. And Caroline, I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing your story and how it inspired you. And now you're out here spreading the information to help other people. So I really appreciate your time and your expertise. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather, for having me.
Cancer can feel like something we can't do anything about. But you can. There are screening tests that can catch cancer early when it may be easier to treat. Begin cervical screening at age 25. At 45, start colorectal and breast screening. At 50, discuss lung screening with a doctor. Find resources for free and low-cost screening at cancer.org/get screened. This is a public service message from the American Cancer Society.
This is Odyssey's I'm Listening. Talk really does have the power to save lives. And I'm Listening is our commitment to inspire more talk about mental health and about suicide prevention and about taking care of our mental health the way we take care of our physical health. I'm Odyssey's David O'Leary. I'm joined by Dr. Christine Moutier, who is the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She also happens to be a leader in the field of suicide prevention, as well as someone who can speak firsthand about the devastation that comes from losing someone to suicide. She also speaks with a little bit of authority on suicide risk and prevention and how suicide affects not just individuals, but communities and families and faith groups and colleagues and so many other communities. Dr. Moutier, it's great to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, David. I certainly consider you a friend and an amazing friend in the fight against suicide, and it's just a pleasure to be here with you.
It is Pride Month. Why is suicide, as well as depression and other mental health issues, a particular concern for those who are in the LGBTQ community?
The first thing I want to say about that is, with regard to any population, including the LGBTQ community, it's not one's identity itself that makes you suffer or puts you at risk. It's the experience that one has based on their identity in the society and in the world and the culture that we live in. And I also think about the fact that LGBTQ people have been marginalized, discriminated against for millennia. And so even though things are changing, some in the right direction, in terms of an understanding of identity as such, not about choice, not about, all the kind of myths of
preference
the past.
And whatnot. Sure.
Right. So I think about that historical backdrop, because if a young person is coming to realize or getting in touch with their own sense of queer identity, depending on the family they live with, the home environment, the larger community, maybe the faith community, all those things can influence what they even find acceptable to think about themselves. So the process of coming out, transitioning, let alone the actual, you know, conversations and changes medically or socially that can occur, all of that presents challenges for individuals who have, like all human beings, have their own backstory in terms of potential genetic loading, family history of depression, anxiety, trauma. You know, all of those things that we know are general risk factors for suicide can be sort of loaded into the background for anyone who goes through anything, mm-hmm. including for queer people who are experiencing, you know, coming to terms with their own identity and then coming out and then the experiences they have in the world around them.
I think that is a huge point. I want to make sure I understand it, so I'm going to restate it and you can keep me honest. It's not because they're in the LGBTQ community that they may be at elevated risk for suicide. It is because of what they have to go through by being members of this community.
Yes.
Circumstantially that may place them at higher risk.
That's right. And I think that is true for, you know, if you look at any group with elevated suicide rates of either, you know, suicidal ideation attempts or tragically in some cases death by suicide, those people groups who have those higher risks, these include some racial ethnic background, American Indian, Alaskan Native, and actually interestingly, middle-aged white males are also among a higher risk category of folks. So there are all sorts of different reasons that relate to those discriminatory experiences, but also when there's a culture that puts shame around help seeking and specifically mental health treatment, those are additional risk factors that can come to bear.
You know, it seems a little ironic and a little sad that at a time when it appears that we're learning more and more about causes and prevention of suicide, and just mental health in general, it's troubling to see what appears to be targeting of specific populations that it would appear seem to be making the problem worse for those populations.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I know it's a complicated world right now in terms of beliefs and, but I would just make a pitch or a plea to all of your listeners to put, you know, any larger agendas aside and just think about the people in our own lives, your family members, your friends, your coworkers. Everyone faces challenges. Everyone has mental health to address and to manage. Some of us also have mental health conditions, which are an additional, I view it as a sort of a responsibility, but one that can be done, just like a physical health condition is something to take care of. And so, you know, to try to just get down to the real basics of these are people we care about, we love, who are in our lives, and some of them, maybe even unbeknownst to us, may be struggling with issues of either mental health or trying to figure out their own identity from an LGBTQ standpoint. So just having that awareness that our behavior makes a big difference for the people around us, giving them permission and inviting, in fact, encouraging them to speak about their internal experiences can be incredibly helpful. You know, there's this group called the Family Acceptance Project, led by Dr. Caitlin Ryan, that studied behaviors in the home that led to very different outcomes for LGBTQ youth, mm-hmm. You know, so for their children or for their siblings. And they broke it down to very concrete, specific behaviors that were ultimately behaviors that either affirmed the person as a human being and as a queer individual, or that showed disrespect. And so there were like literally 100 behaviors that they studied, and night and day, different outcomes in terms of even things like becoming homeless, risk of HIV/AIDS, mm-hmm. but legal issues, academic problems, but also risk of suicidal behavior. Night and day difference based on those concrete behaviors happening in the home.
And I bet some of those behaviors are very subtle and very nuanced. It's like the language that we use and what we would consider little things that are very impactful, to your point.
Yes. I think making an effort and using someone's identified pronouns. There's research actually that some of which AFSP funded that shows that using correct pronouns for an individual actually reduces their odds of having suicidal thoughts. And so again, these are complicated matters, but if again, putting yourself in the shoes of someone who on a larger scale, on a macro level in society, if you think about my identity may put me at risk for, you know, violence, discrimination, problems getting any number of things, employment, housing, relationship stress. But now in my own home environment, I have a parent or a sibling who is using my pronouns, introducing me to mentors in the queer community, requiring other family members to treat me with compassion, love, and respect. You know, those are protective experiences for a young person.
Yeah, those protection factors. I mean, we've talked about them in terms of suicide prevention. They're protective factors for your health. You get a good night's sleep. You exercise a little bit. You're going to lower your risk for, you name it, whatever the physical health issue. And these are emotional health issues and mental health protective factors. I guess I would imagine that when you are when you hear this kind of language in the home, it affirms that you're in a safe place and you're in a good place. It's a protective factor.
Yes. And I think intersecting with wherever the person is in their own journey, which, you know, for young people may be intersecting them at some particularly vulnerable times because the job, the psychological milestone, the job of a teenager is essentially to establish their own autonomy, you know? And so it's a complicated time anyway, let alone if there is, our opinions and differences about who that person in fact is becoming and who they are.
I want to ask you how to reach out to someone if you're concerned. There's a way to reach out.
Absolutely. And it's really to set up a private time so that there's a space where they can optimally feel able to talk about potentially very private things that they're going through. You know, I think realizing that people are experiencing challenges at different times, they won't necessarily tell you that that's what's going on in their life, right? Depending on your relationship with them. So you have to use the little clues that kind of make your instincts say, gosh, they don't seem like themselves. What might be going on with them? So the first thing is just really trusting your gut instinct. Don't write it off that it's somebody else's job. I'm not trained as a mental health professional. You know, we use all kinds of excuses. I don't want to offend them. So what this approach looks like is really just establishing a safe, caring, supportive conversation. And so don't hesitate to use those words, because if someone is struggling, remember the automatic instinct that we have as human beings, and I think this is actually a very primitive kind of primal instinct, is when we feel vulnerable, we withdraw and we put the boundaries up and we feel vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And as human beings, we have that big frontal lobe that gives us a big experience of shame, vulnerability, fear. And so as the supportive person, you need to actually say it. I'm here having this conversation with you because simply because I care and I want to support you. And it's a judgment-free zone because I've been through stuff too. And it feels so counterintuitive because we all want to get into the fix it mode. It's just, you know, those of us who, most of us are problem solvers, but the job, the task is really different here. It's simply showing that you care, that you're able to hear it and listen and not run away and not judge and not minimize it, but just simply, you know, it's those active listening skills that most of us are so bad at, that just really hears what they're saying, even reflects back, is this what I hear you saying? I want to be here for you. Tell me more about that. You know, those kind of phrases. Now, if the person is sounding hopeless, like they feel trapped in their circumstances, or like they feel like they're a burden to others. Those are indicators to me that they could be having thoughts of suicide. And so in those instances, I will ask, I will say exactly what the words they said. When you say this, X, Y, and Z, when you say that, it makes me wonder if you're having thoughts of ending your life. And you have to zip it, because oftentimes our own nerves are going in these conversations, and just listen. Mm-hmm. And again, if you're not sure what to do, you can always call 988 for some guidance. But the odds that they are imminently, immediately at risk for suicide are actually very low, because now they're talking about it. Opening up actually feels like a relief to people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts. And I think, you know, again, offering to help them find some professional help, I think would be an important step to take if a person is having suicidal thoughts.
I'm so glad you mentioned 988. And if you are struggling, or if you love someone who you're concerned may be struggling, that is the number to call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There is care on the other end of that line. 988 is the number. In the short time we have left, I want to sort of look for hope and optimism here. And it does seem, you know, we're talking about suicide and mental health in a way that we weren't even 5-10 years ago. And we're talking about the LGBTQ community in a way that we weren't a couple of years ago, notwithstanding that there's targeted legislation and other issues that are challenging for those in that community. But do you see signs of hope?
I certainly do. And I think, you know, to be in the field of suicide prevention, I probably have to be a little wired with some optimism, but it's also based on science and data that we see dialogue happening like never before. We see people reaching out for mental health support and treatment like never before. And, you know, I look at the younger generation, particularly in the LGBTQ community. There is advocacy and sense of community together and with allies that is very strong now. These are more common and prevalent experiences of identifying with an LGBTQ type of identity. So in that generation, I do think as they grow up, there's going to be greater and greater understanding that these are normal parts of being human, and hopefully some of the stigma will continue to diminish.
Dr. Christine Moutier is the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. It is always wonderful chatting with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Take care.
And this is I'm Listening from Odyssey. To share your story or to find others, search for I'm Listening on the Odyssey app.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Flavors for Life is the Las Vegas Mini Grand Prix Charity of the Month for June. Just purchase the one-hour Mega Ride wristband at the 7-acre Mini Grand Prix Amusement Park and mention Flavors this Tuesday, June 27th. That will support Flavors for Life in their mission of teaching high school students how to cook and eat healthy to help beat the obesity epidemic. So visit the Las Vegas Mini Grand Prix this Tuesday, purchase the Mega Ride wristband, mention Flavors, and some of the proceeds will go to support Flavors for Life. You can find out more at flavorsforlife.org. That's flavorsforlife.org. Junior Achievement of Southern Nevada is holding the second annual Golden Ticket Raffle with a new winner-take-all package. You can purchase your ticket for $100 through midnight on June 29th for a June 30th drawing. All proceeds go to support Junior Achievement programs that promote financial literacy for kids. Purchase tickets or get more information at thegoldenticket.org. That's thegoldenticket.org. Walker Furniture is seeking nomination letters for its 9th annual Help for Heroes program, which provides specialized furniture to help wounded active military or veterans. Nominate yourself or a loved one by submitting a letter by Saturday, July 8th. Just outline who the furniture is for, what they need, and why. 12 recipients will be chosen from all the nominees to receive their free specialized furniture. You can drop your letter off at either the Henderson or MLK Walker Furniture locations or submit it online at walkerfurniture.com. That's walkerfurniture.com. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, July 10th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, and Monday, July 24th at 8 p.m. benefiting Project for Humanity. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. Project Access is seeking donations for their back-to-school event to help kids living in affordable housing communities in Las Vegas. You can drop off school supplies at the Project Access Family Resource Center at Accent on Decatur, 2950 South Decatur Boulevard, north of Desert Inn, before Monday, July 17th. Find out more at project-access.org. That's project-access.org. Victory Outreach Church is holding a free back-to-school event with free school supplies for the kids on Saturday, July 29th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Paradise McLeod Park, McLeod and Tropicana. There will also be free haircuts, entertainment, music, food, giveaways, and more. Find out the details at volasvegas.com. That's volasvegas.com. And the Las Vegas Clark County Library District's free summer challenge program is running through July 31st, with lots of prizes for kids and adults, including bookstore items, water bottles, tote bags, museum tickets, a telescope, a $100 Amazon gift card, and cool swag from the Vegas Golden Knights. Sign up to track your progress or find out more at thelibrarydistrict.org/summerchallenge. That's thelibrarydistrict.org/summerchallenge.